Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The number of alcohol-related deaths in the U.S. increased by 35% from 2007 to 2017. That's according to a new analysis from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. USA Today reporter Jane O'Donnell has been covering the rise of alcohol-related deaths in the U.S. We'll post a link to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Jane O'Donnell joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Why now? Why during that 10-year period? Is there any sense about what that's related to?
I don't think that there's anything conclusive, but the experts who have studied it say that it's definitely related to stress. It's definitely related to women in particular having more stress as we perhaps climb higher and higher in the corporate ladder, get jobs such as one of the lawyer that I wrote about, whose father was so poignantly described the death of his daughter, as she faced. You're dealing with client dinners. You're a law partner. You're expected to spend time with clients, and there's a lot of alcohol involved with that. People in sales, there's a lot of alcohol in that. There's also social media can lead to depression and anxiety among people who ironically, I looked at some of the pictures of people who have talked to us on our Facebook group, which, by the way, is called I Survived It. And, you know, they have picture-perfect families on social media, but they often have very debilitating alcoholism in their families.
And this has been mostly affecting the numbers have ticked up mostly with women and younger people.
Yeah, younger. When I say younger, younger than you would expect.
Okay.
So, as one of the mothers whose daughter died at 32 said to me, you know, I have family members who drank, you know, very excessively, very alcoholically into their 70s and 80s and didn't die of alcohol. And she lost a daughter at 32 after just a few years, 3 to 5 years. I can't remember. But one young woman died after 3 years, or a young man died after 3 years. A young woman died after drinking heavily for 5 years, but it's also in middle age, so 40s and 50-somethings are now dying.
And, you know, I guess when we say alcohol-related deaths, a lot of times we're just thinking, accidents, drunk driving,
right,
that kind of a thing, but that's not what we're talking about necessarily.
Yeah, and that's right. And I was amazed. I'm a health reporter. I'm somebody who quit drinking 26 years ago. I was amazed because I hadn't thought about all of these cancers. And I've known people who are alcoholics who died of cancer, and I never really made the connection. I mean, you might make the connection if it was liver cancer, but other cancers. I found it quite interesting, very sad, of course, that breast cancer, about 15% of breast cancer cases are related to alcohol, and it's even a very small amount of alcohol. I believe it was 1.5 drinks a week that was linked to increased risk of breast cancer.
How do they know that it's linked? Is it just correlation? It's not necessarily causation, right?
Right, exactly. It's the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, I think that's at the University of Washington, mm-hmm. has done a very, very deep dive into this. They have lots of Gates Foundation money. So they've looked at, they're able to extrapolate, you know, where the drinking is. They've got medical records. They've got all sorts of data. So where the heaviest drinking is, and they can estimate, you know, how much of it is suicide, for example. Oh. How much of it is cirrhosis of the liver? How much of it is cancer, and what kind of cancer? As I mentioned in the story, it's cancers from the mouth to the colon, all along the digestive tract.
Are there other things that they correlate these with, though, besides drinking?
Oh, yeah, they do this for everything.
Mm-hmm.
They do this for all sorts of. We're looking at doing a piece on depression soon, and they. I'm not sure exactly how that would work, because I don't think it usually kills you unless it's suicide. But
mm-hmm.
But yes, they do. They kind of cross reference them, so it's quite interesting data.
When they talk about suicide and alcohol, is that being suicide by alcohol?
It's kind of a combination. Like, for example, the woman in the Erica Erica Byrd, the woman who is focused on in the lead and mm-hmm. throughout the story, she had actually tried to kill herself a couple of times, but through pills. So it's not that you, it isn't really, to answer your question, not drinking yourself, like, you know, drinking, you know,
Vegas kind of drinking. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that it's that, but it's that these are people who commit suicide who are drinking and are drinking very heavily, because it's got to be. I mean, again, even as somebody who drank excessively, I mean, it seems like an awfully hard way to live and die. So, I mean, you know, it surprised me that this is killing more people than opioid overdoses, because that seems easier.
Yeah, and it is that you think you've made the point that this issue has been obscured by the opioid epidemic.
Right. And I'm not making a judgment on that, but I will tell you that a lot of the parents I spoke to are offended by that, and that a lot of some of the grants and federal funding, and probably state and local as well, are excluding alcohol. They're really just focused on opioids, which many people say is a mistake. I did a piece a couple month or two ago on, like, meth use is way up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been hearing that more and more, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, people, it's, and people are, I think the term is, like, poly-substance. They're usually not doing just one thing either. Now, the people that I focused on died strictly from alcohol, and those deaths were because of alcohol. Were they not drinking, they would not have gotten liver cancer or even esophageal cancer or colon cancer.
Let's see. David in Upper Arlington, you are on the air with USA Today reporter Jane O'Donnell. Hi, David.
Hi. I think a large part of the problem is because we do not have a health care system that addresses it. It's not that the health care system is broken. It's that it does not exist for addiction. Secondly, we do not have community education about how to recover, where to go. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, David. Jane O'Donnell?
Yes, and he makes a very good point, and I address it in the story. I touch on it in the solution story that ran on Monday. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about this morning. So, number one, we have a healthcare system that actually makes more money, so they're better off, most of them, unless you're on Medicare the hospital is part of one of these pilot projects that pay you based on the value of your care. If you're not in one of those, you're going to get paid more the more times I come to get my stomach pumped or my whatever done, you know, the vomit aspirated or I crash my car, blah, blah, blah. Not that you would necessarily, I'm not saying the hospitals want that to happen, mm-hmm. but they have no financial interest in keeping me well. Only 1 in 10 people who need addiction treatment in this country can get it. And when it is available, they're often not getting you when you're most likely to say yes to it. Mm-hmm. You're not. They need to get you, just as with an opioid addict, they need to get you when you're right in the hospital and have just recovered. They need to have what they call a warm handoff to a treatment center.
Some states are hit harder by this than others. What do we know about that?
Well, the South has a particular problem with this. As somebody pointed out, you know, I had also mentioned that I can't remember if it was Alabama, I think, had actually some pretty tough laws when it came to alcohol, mm-hmm. but they still had a very high death rate.
It's harder to get alcohol. They have more blue laws,
of thing. Yeah, like there aren't as many. There's more restrictions on how many alcohol liquor stores there can be, and the taxes might be high. But there's also so many more health problems in the South. Any, I've been covering health for over 5 years, and anytime you do one of those state-by-state things, it almost gets silly to even do them, because it generally is the same states time and again. And
the poorest states in the South.
The poorest states, and they also don't have Medicaid coverage for everybody. Again, not making a political statement other than to make the observation that these are people that can't get health care, like that are often poor. And if you're a chronic alcoholic, you're probably not working.
How does Ohio stack up?
Ohio, I actually forget. Let's look. I know they certainly. We own the Cincinnati paper, and I know they certainly. Mm-hmm. I work closely with the let's click on Ohio.
I would say in Ohio, it's probably pretty regional. You'd have to drill down to just because Ohio has so many different facets to it.
Right.
Big cities, lots of rural, and Appalachia for that matter.
Yeah. Oh, here's the, where is Ohio? Change in alcohol deaths. Wow. They were up 45%. Mm. The deaths per 100,000, male 39, female 1. Mm-hmm. And they're one of the darker states. Yeah, so there's Ohio wasn't looking too good. Hmm. Not the worst. So in the 31, yeah, well, actually in the second highest. So there's four categories, and so they're in the 41 to 50% increase.
When we talk about deaths among women rising 85% during that 10-year period, that's an increase, a percentage increase. In raw numbers, do men still outnumber women in terms of alcohol-related deaths?
Yes, yes. More men die. Let me make sure I say this right. So more men drink heavily, so more men die. But the increase is much faster for women, mm-hmm. So we're catching up.
And there's also an age piece to that too.
Younger
women.
Yes, it's starting to be younger women too.
And is treatment the only conclusion in terms of turning this around?
Well, access to treatment. I mean, of course, you know, it's some of it's personal. You have to be willing to get help. Mm-hmm. You can't feel hopeless. I mean, in my personal case, my life turned around very quickly, and I didn't have a bad life to begin with. But mm-hmm. You know, the opportunities became quite. I got a lot more employment opportunities, mm-hmm. And if you're in an area of Ohio or any other state where there aren't many employment opportunities or much to do. I was talking with someone this morning about like how people need to know, and young people in particular need to know that there are ways to have fun without alcohol, but so many parts of the country don't really have much to do. There's not much amusement, places mm-hmm. to go.
So they start drinking out and doing
keggers
in the fields and stuff.
Yeah, and yeah. drugs and all of that. So it's you know, recognizing you have a problem. Joining AA has been getting a lot of shout outs in our I Survived It group. People really, because you develop a new community. I mean, yeah. I know I couldn't imagine what other people did. I grew up in a very Irish bar kind of centric area. We knew all the bar owners, and it was a lot of fun. It mm-hmm. wasn't all the negative stuff about alcohol back then. And I couldn't imagine what people did with themselves that weren't drinking. Like, how boring.
You know, that the issue of alcohol poisoning has been obscured by the opioid epidemic, but there's got to be a lot of comorbidity in that, right? A lot of, you know, there's...
Very much so, yeah. Yes. Yes, I don't have the statistics mm-hmm. statistics on me, but there was a statistic in the story. I believe, was it 15% or 20%? Were also have opioid in their system. So this very interesting report that I'd point your listeners to called Pain in the Nation, that was done by something called the Wellbeing Trust. So they showed the overlap with suicide as well as opioids. Oh, it's 1 in 5. So 1 in 5 of the people who died have alcohol in their system. So 1 in 5 of the people who died from opioid overdoses have alcohol in their systems.
Wow. Well, Jane O'Donnell, thanks for your reporting, and thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Okay, my pleasure. I'm glad you had me on.
Jane O'Donnell, USA Today reporter. She has been talking about the issue of alcohol-related deaths in the U.S., increased by 35% from 2007 to 2017, and increased by 85% among women. If you want to check it out, we'll have a link to her articles on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. You've heard the old adage that love hurts, and when love ends, it can hurt even more. Today, we're talking about the ache and heartache and how to better understand what's going on physically and mentally when you go through a breakup. Cale Monk is an assistant professor of human development and family science at the University of Missouri, Columbia, where he studies romantic relationships and their impact on mental health. Welcome to the show, Cale Monk.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's talk about what got you into this and what we're talking about when we say breaking up and pain.
Yeah, so a lot of people, when they'll typically ask me the question if I have personal experience with this, and I got particularly interested in the process of breaking up when I was in college, and that's because a great percentage, around 35 to 45% of young adults report that they break up and get back together with a partner. And we're seeing that that's typically part of the process of ending a relationship, that people will they'll get disinterested or dissatisfied with their relationship, and they'll make steps towards leaving it, but then they'll potentially have a conversation and try to work things out with their partner. And this was particularly true for me, and I eventually went into a therapy program and started seeing couples, and I was seeing a lot of people struggle with breakup and that process of ending relationships, and it can be really challenging for people. And when we think about it, relationships are really, really critical in our lives, but it's not something we typically talk about with our doctors. So I think that it's something that's important and needs to be part of the conversation when we talk about mental health.
So when you have your annual checkup and your doctor says, what's going on in your life, anything happening, that's something you should bring up.
Yeah, if you have any major life events, for example, divorce has been long considered one of the greatest stressors in our lives, right up there with losing a partner or the death of a partner. And so I think that some of these major life events, if it's causing you stress, definitely talk with a provider about it, especially a mental health provider.
How much does it matter when it comes to who ends things? Is it less painful if you're the one ending it versus being the one the one that's getting left behind?
Yes, and I always struggle with what to call it. I don't want to say the dumper and the dumpy, so the left and the leaver, or the rejected and the rejecter, there's certainly some distance there or differences there. Everyone experiences some degree of distress, or I should say most people experience some degree of distress, because even if the relationship was highly dissatisfactory, breakup and divorce, there's a lot of changes. It's not just a discrete event. You've probably been distressed for a while, and there is some there's a recovery period afterwards. But we definitely see that those who were left behind or feel rejected definitely struggle the most or experience the most upset after a breakup.
Is a function of this just aging? Do people age faster because of this?
I don't know necessarily about that. When people talk about age with breakup, they're typically talking about maturity. And, for example, there's often people talking about the statistics on divorce, and those who get married younger tend to divorce at a higher rate. But I will say that there is some degree of when you experience a breakup, potentially there's a lot of growth that can happen, right? Which people talk about that coming with age as well.
What are the signs that you're in trouble, that the recovery from a relationship is not going well for you?
Yeah, so as part of that pattern of breaking up, people typically talk about obviously feeling a level of dissatisfaction and maybe growing bored or disinterested in the relationship, but that's not typically the main reason people are ending the or that is kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. There usually needs to be something where they feel like they can actually live without their partner, or they would actually be better off, I should say, without their partner. And so, for example, beginning to notice alternative partners or just being single starts to feel more appealing. And that's usually what does it. But, of course, there are sometimes big events that happen as well, such as infidelity or violence that could also spurn those thoughts.
As far as whether you know that you're not doing well, depression is something that kind of follows up for a lot of people.
Yeah, so it's really difficult to disentangle the temporal order of some of these mechanisms. So obviously, if you're experiencing depression or anxiety or some form of distress, this can impact your level of satisfaction with the relationship. It can impact the relationship's quality. But also, we see that the quality of the relationship affects our mental health. So these things are really, really difficult to disentangle. And in some ways, I'm not sure that disentangling it really matters. We know that if we intervene on one, it can oftentimes help the other. So these are two processes or two domains that we do need to focus on.
Should people get counseling before they break up to make sure that it's not something intrinsic in their relationship, that maybe it's something external that could be affected?
Sure. And a lot of people, especially with breakup, they report that they didn't make much of an effort to improve the relationship. Usually people get dissatisfied and then they'll maybe leave hints or disguised strategies to try to end the relationship before they overtly end it. But they never really have this conversation with their partner that they're dissatisfied, which could lead to them potentially working on it. And there is a lot of, for example, self-help books out there that are focused on how do we prevent breakup and how do we improve relationships. And certainly that's good because sometimes people talk about how the best times in their relationship are after a really dark period. And if they wouldn't have worked on the relationship, they would have missed out on the best parts. And that certainly does happen. But I'm a firm advocate based on my research that some breakup is good. Like, we don't want to push people too strongly to try to make their relationship work, especially if they're dissatisfied. They're likely going to be dissatisfied in the future. And so it's a really tricky process. And I think meeting with a therapist or a trained professional can help people navigate that decision.
Are people any better at seeking therapy when there's marriage problems than they used to be?
I believe so, yes. So a lot of people, when I was a couple and family therapist, would come in and they wanted to talk about their relationships because that was the most salient thing in their mind. That was the thing that they felt was causing them the distress that they were experiencing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times that was attached to anxiety or depression for them, like they were experiencing anxiety because they were fighting a lot with their partner. And so I think that talking about relationships sometimes is more comfortable for people, and that can be helpful. And of course, the inverse of that is true, right? Like, some people may not recognize that their depression is stemming from this toxic relationship with a family member or a romantic partner. So it certainly goes both ways.
What about the role of, we've talked about infidelity, but violence in relationships and how that plays out when it comes to breakups?
Yeah, and I appreciate you bringing that up because that's something that's really tricky, and particularly my research on breaking up and getting back together on-again, off-again relationships. We see a high correlation with people who have experienced violence, and so a lot of times people return to a relationship for a variety of reasons, like maybe they have shared property, like they own a home together, or they feel guilty about something. They feel like it was their fault, and so they feel driven to return to this relationship, even when it's really unsafe. And so I always try to encourage people that if you feel unsafe or having these types of conversations with your partner could lead to safety concerns, that you definitely want to seek services when it's safe to do so.
I wanted to go back to the point you made about people who marry when they're younger have a higher mm-hmm. rate of breakup. Why is that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of a lot of experiences and transitions that people go through in adulthood, changing jobs, making these big life decisions. And I think that sometimes people can get married too soon. They can rush into their relationship. And some researchers refer to it as sliding versus deciding. So they can slide in to relationships, transitions, so such as living together or getting married, for a variety of reasons. And so let's just take the example of cohabiting. So a partner might leave a toothbrush at and their partner's house, or before they know it, they have a drawer of clothing, and then all of a sudden they live together when they didn't actually make a concrete decision. And this can be challenging because we build up these constraints, like we maybe sign a lease together or we get a dog together, and it makes it harder to leave a relationship when they are of lower quality. And so people might get married, for example, just because they think it's the next step when they really haven't thought it through and contemplated, is this really what I want at this point in my life? And because of all these transitions that we go through during the transition to adulthood, people may not know who they are, and so they may themselves change, and the person that you married might be different from the person that you're with now, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's not literally, but...
But the roles change.
Yeah,
and people change with their roles.
Exactly.
And so what kind of cautions do you have for people out there? I mean, you know, really think about it. Should... is the pain of breakup something you want to avoid?
That's a great question. So a lot of people will stay in relationships because they want to avoid the distress that they think that they're going to have. But research pretty consistently shows we're not good forecasters about how distressed we're going to be. And certainly some breakups are way more distressing than others, particularly this is true of divorce. But oftentimes it's not as bad as we think it's going to be. And there's definitely a recovery period for most people. But oftentimes this distress is considered fleeting and temporary. And so people tend to rebound or recover after a period of time. And so there are a variety of factors that help with this. One thing that I think is really beneficial is finding silver lining and what I mean by that is thinking about what did I learn from this past relationship? How can I grow from this? And people who have this mindset tend to do better after a breakup. And so I think that that's one thing that's really helpful. Also preventing rumination, like if we're dwelling in the past and thinking about all the things we could have done differently or things that maybe we did wrong and that we regret, what could I have done differently, that can stifle our ability to move on. And so I think that that's really hard. And things like Facebook and stalking our exes make that challenging. So I definitely encourage people to try to look forward instead of dwelling in the past.
How do family and friends figure in?
That's a great question as well, because support is really, really vital. But there's kind of a paradox, because when you're with someone, you're usually enmeshed in their networks. You maybe become friends with their family members, friends with their friends. And when there's a split, oftentimes friends feel forced to choose between one partner or the other. And so sometimes we can lose some of our network, but it becomes really critical to find people who support you after this decision, because it's something that's really important and really helpful in that recovery process.
Cale Monk, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Kale Monk is assistant professor of human development and family science at the University of Missouri Columbia, where he studies the impact of breakups on our mental health. We're going to continue our conversation, Wellness Wednesday. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Food and Drug Administration proposed restrictions on flavored e-cigarettes and tobacco products last week. New York Times health and behavior reporter Jan Hoffman has been covering the issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann. I appreciate it.
Tell us about these proposed restrictions. What's the upshot?
Okay. We're just going to speak specifically about e-cigarettes. Now, we're not going to talk, as far as I know, about the menthol and flavored cigar bans.
Okay.
But right now, the FDA is proposing to restrict the sales of flavored e-cigarettes in basically what will amount to convenience stores and vape shops in the following manner. It's saying that the stores have to have the products essentially, quote unquote, segregated in a way that only adults can gain access to them. There's critical exceptions to this. They are going to allow menthol flavor, mint flavor, and tobacco flavored e-cigarettes to still be sold out in the public domain. And the reason for that is because they don't want those flavors to disappear while those flavored cigarettes are still on the market. They want people to still have an alternative. How that translates and what that's going to mean practically is going to be very interesting. That's where some of the fights are going to start taking place.
Why is that?
Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, the primary producer of e-cigarettes, the infamous and famous Juul, itself announced restrictions that are even more limited than the FDA's just 6 days earlier. Juul itself said it's taking all of its products except for those three flavors out of stores completely, and that consumers will only be able to buy them online if they follow certain very strict age verification procedures that Juul is going to set up. So the FDA is already a little bit more loose than Juul itself. The other problem that the FDA is going to have is that it has said very loosely segregated, not accessible, and not visible to minors, meaning under 18.
Mm-hmm.
But does that mean if you're a convenience store that you can keep it under a counter? I mean, it's not accessible and it's not visible.
Mm-hmm.
The FDA hasn't specified that yet. What that does mean is if you go to your local vape shop or tobacco shop, the simple way they cure that problem is they simply say, this is an adults-only store, and they can still keep their products out. But that raises another problem because under something called, hang in there with me,
mm-hmm.
under something called the Tobacco Control Act of 2009, the FDA cannot discriminate against one form of commercial sales against another. So they can't make it harder for convenience stores and easier for vape shops. So, you know, look on the horizon for litigation.
Mm, right. Litigation. In litigation, mm-hmm. do you think that'll put the kibosh on it in the short term?
Well, I'm not a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not a vapor. All I can speculate and guess is whether that'll put a kibosh or not, I don't know. It could slow things down. The FDA has said it's going to try to specify language about how it envisions this happening. But I do know, I've spoken already to convenience store lawyers who said,
mm-hmm.
this is not going to happen fast. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Why are they picking on the flavored vapes?
Well, I happen to be the parent of two teenagers,
mm-hmm.
and they and their friends are very curious about flavors called mango, unicorn milk, chicken and waffles, banana strawberry, popsicle. So many of these flavors at least by name alone, seem completely targeted at underage smokers. That's why the FDA is going after the flavored e-cigarettes, because they really want to deter teenage and even younger kids from picking up e-cigarettes.
And is there evidence of that?
Oh, yeah. The latest numbers from the CDC, they issue an annual tobacco behavioral health survey each year, is they estimate right now that 3.6 million middle school and high school kids have smoked or vaped e-cigarettes within the last 30 days. And that's up 75% from the numbers the year before.
Wow. They're not cheap, though. I've never bought any, so I actually don't know what they cost and that kind of thing.
Well, to get what's – and I'm going to only talk about Juul in this regard, because there are – forget the fine math on this. Let's just say a modest kajillion of them out there, and the prices vary. But Juul, which has about 70% of the market, the starter kit for Juul can run about $50. And if you're familiar at all with how it works, the so-called flash drive or the e-cigarette module itself takes a small cartridge or pod. A pack of four pods, depending on where you get it, can range anywhere from $16 to $20. And it also depends how long it takes you to go through one of these cartridges. So once you get the starter kit, it could cost you, if you're going through a pod a day, which is equivalent nicotine-wise of a pack of cigarettes a day, it could cost you about $40 a week. Now, it depends whether you consider that a lot or a little.
I consider that
a lot.
Lot
of money.
Yeah.
It is a lot of money. However, if you are a cigarette smoker, it is considerably less than cigarettes.
Which is why I quit 30 years ago. all right. So, and there's evidence that that when kids start vaping, that this is a gateway to cigarette smoking.
Well, that's highly controversial.
Okay.
All right. There are, as far as I know, there's nothing conclusive that says absolutely, you know, slam dunk. There are studies that show some sort of relationship between the two. What scientists are starting to say is that it increases their risk of moving from e-cigarettes to tobacco smoking. That means the possibility that they might is increased. It doesn't necessarily mean they absolutely will. However, one thing, you know, that is not known yet is, are kids who go from vaping to cigarettes, were they inclined to go to cigarettes anyway? And this is just one more step along the way, or is this an actual open door to an experience they might not otherwise have had? The research is still too young to be able to really determine with confidence that causal relationship. They do see a relationship, but they don't know if it's causal.
Now, the first kind of cigarettes I smoked 150 years ago were menthol. And the FDA also wants to outlaw menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. You wrote that those two that policy would disproportionately harm African Americans. What's the connection there?
I wouldn't harm them. No.
Affect them? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Sorry, wrong word. Okay.
No, that's okay. Leaders in those communities and public health officials have said for many, many, many years that teenagers and young adult African-American and Latino smokers do tend to disproportionately smoke menthol-flavored cigarettes and flavored cigars. So, in fact, they have been pleading for this kind of a ban for many, many years. If I remember correctly, and please don't quote me, I believe that menthol cigarettes are banned in Canada. So, however, the tobacco industry, big tobacco, is going to fight that particular ban very, very hard. The menthol cigarettes represent, I've read everywhere from 35 to 40% of their sales. And they are really going to get, really dig their heels in to try to fight this. The FDA does have very circumscribed ways that it can impose restrictions. So, for example, it could restrict the quote-unquote sales of flavored e-cigarettes, but enforcing an all-out ban on a type of tobacco takes a series of procedures. And even if it goes through, if it passes all the rungs on the ladder, it could take about a year or two at the very least. But they will be really they'll be mud wrestling about this one. That's for sure.
What has changed? Why are they doing this now? Is there a new leadership? Is there more evidence? Or is there they just can't dodge it anymore? What's going on?
Yes,
I just made that up too. So
yes, you just covered the waterfront. The FDA commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, has said from the outset that taking on big tobacco and taking on particularly e-cigarettes was going to be one of his main missions for as long as he held his job. Now the e-cigarette sales are a particular concern about teenagers, because of the high amount of nicotine in e-cigarettes. They don't have tobacco, but they do have nicotine, which is very, very addictive. And for the teenage brain, is even more vulnerable to becoming addicted on nicotine than even adults. So that was one portion of his huge concern. And because minority communities had for years protested so angrily that there were restrictions on tobacco and on sales of cigarettes, but that the FDA had excluded an aggressive ban on menthol at the expense of their communities. And so basically he's trying to sort of be a good public health citizen and be aware of both sort of averting harm to teenagers and averting further harm to communities of color.
Does anyone or anything regulate the amount of nicotine that can be in cigarettes/e-cigarettes?
Okay. Two different piles there.
Okay. Gotcha.
All right. Hold my hand. We're going to go into the weeds.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm ready.
All right. Let's talk about traditional tobacco cigarettes, first of all. The FDA, certainly under the Tobacco Control Act, can begin to raise questions of how much nicotine is in a cigarette. Now, they have already banned flavors other than menthol in cigarettes. When it comes to tobacco, they have discussed the possibility of lowered nicotine levels for cigarettes. That's just been a topic that's been floating in the ether for a number of years. It's unclear whether their focus on the menthol ban in e-cigarettes is going to push that aside or not. That remains to be seen. Okay, that's one side of the conversation. Mm-hmm. That's tobacco cigarettes. E-cigarettes are in a little bit vaguer territory for the FDA. They are known as quote-unquote tobacco products for the sake of the Tobacco Control Act, even though they generally don't have tobacco in them. And furthermore, they have a clock. I really don't want to pull you too further in the weeds. You could choke on them. Trust me on this. But there's a clock by which they have a couple of more years to show data that they are not harming public health, and that they can, in fact, that they are tobacco products that, quote unquote, be beneficial for public health. That is why right now the commissioner can't wade in at this moment, as far as I know, to completely regulate how much nicotine is in e-cigarettes, because they haven't actually been formalized for market yet. They can't even be approved by the FDA yet as smoking cessation aids. So he can begin to have that vigorous conversation about tobacco cigarettes. E-cigarettes is a little further down the road.
Do you cover chewing tobacco?
I haven't written about it personally, but we have written about it, yes.
Is this affected by any of this?
Is chewing tobacco affected by
it?
Truth in advertising?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Okay.
I could yammer and give you an answer and speculate, but my ability to yammer and speculate is far greater than my ability to come up with an actual answer without formal knowledge.
I appreciate that. All right. So then what about the role of advertising in, you know, in selling these products to, I guess, mostly younger people, right?
Yes. Juul itself has said it's ending all of its social media programs.
Huh. Okay.
And that it will not, you know, go on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook to continue, where obviously kids can have super access
right.
to this stuff. However, if you just even put in any of the little search words like, you know, vaping, cloud, you name it, mm-hmm. into Twitter, into Instagram, onto YouTube, really, Juul doesn't have to do a lot of marketing. The kids are doing it for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's already out there. There are numerous YouTube videos with kids showing how they demonstrate different Juuling tricks, how they can blow clouds and, you know, all kinds of things. While it's good that Juul is being a good corporate citizen in this regard, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, the horse left the barn already and you
right.
want to close the door, right? Like, thanks a lot.
Well,
let me just tell you one other thing. Juul also left the door open. It has said that when convenience stores and other retailers do due diligence and come up with and accede to Juul's own age verification process, Juul will consider putting its products back in their stores.
As long as they pull back, that discourages regulators from going forward, right? Or at least that's the theory. And then,
well,
they can change their mind in the future.
Yes, because the regulators would much prefer that the companies do it voluntarily rather than the regulators come in and have a heavy hand mm-hmm. and possibly risk themselves litigation and blowback.
It's
always better to get the companies to do it voluntarily.
Has there been any discussion about a black market on this and how it could create a black market if a no-no?
Here's the question is what already exists. So, for example, I did a long profile of a teenager, an underage vapor, who got terribly caught up in a nicotine addiction. I mean, a two-year, really, Juul had its hands around his throat, almost literally. The truth is that he told me, and this is very common, and the FDA knows this, and Juul knows this, is that often adults or people of age buy these products online in bulk and then sell it to underage kids.
Mm.
A lot of kids get their vapes from older kids or, you know, kids in, like, particularly in communities where the minimum age is 18 rather than 21.
Mm-hmm.
Or they get it from someone who buys in bulk and sells it to them.
Yeah.
And that's one of the biggest challenges in regulating all this. The commissioner has also suggested several different ideas for how to limit those kind of bulk sales. Same thing with Juul. But again, this is all, you know, a little bit, you know, back of the envelope stuff. It's certainly of concern.
Well, Jan Hoffman, we're out of time. I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too.
Romaine.
Thank you. Jan Hoffman, New York Times health and behavior reporter. We'll have a link to her articles about vaping and regulations on our website at WOSU.org. I want to say thanks to the All Sides staff. Wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. Producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, the All Sides interns Martin Coleman, Kaylin Martin, Maisie Glockner, and Ray Brewster, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Couldn't do it without our radio operations director Kevin Petrilla or senior broadcast technician Eric French. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
It's 11:59 on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Debbie Holmes. Stick around. On Point is coming up next from noon to 2. An international roundtable discusses the issues Brexit, Khashoggi, and Saudi Arabia, and the APEC summit. That's coming up next here on 89.7. Support for All Sides with Ann Fisher.